a comprehensive view of the multifaceted attack on mitochondrial health, including EMF, of course, blue light, seed oils, and glyphosate, plus the obvious solutions, featuring Tristan Scott of Decentralized Radio, coming up.
EMF Remedy is dedicated to helping you understand which electromagnetic threats are present in your home, and whether in the context of your current home, one you're considering for purchase, or building a new home with comprehensive protection designed in, EMF Remedy can help you reduce your family's exposure to harmful, man-made electromagnetic radiation.
Hi, this is Keith Cutter with EMFRemedy.com, host of the EMF Remedy podcast. Today, I have an interview for you conducted with Tristan Scott. Tristan is an advocate of decentralized health. In this interview, we discuss many things having to do with mitochondrial harm, as well as obvious elements of the solution. Here we go. My guest today is Tristan Scott. Tristan is an electrical engineer. More importantly than that, even, he is the host of Decentralized Radio. It's a podcast, and he also has his work up on Substack, where he goes by the name of Decentralized Health. Welcome, Tristan.
Thanks for having me, Keith. It's great to be on the show.
Absolutely. My pleasure. So I really have been enjoying getting in touch with your work recently. I was introduced to you through a mutual friend. And one of the articles that you published recently having to do with sunlight and the fact that there is no replacement for sunlight, I'd like to spend some time on that if we could. And also maybe touch some of the other things that you've done recently, maybe very briefly, the deuterium water and the glyphosate story and whatnot, if we get into those. And for my listeners, I really want to introduce you to Tristan because I think he's great, doing a great job of looking in particular in the healthcare arena, or in the health arena, I should say, at decentralization and what that means. So we're going to try to explore that in this topic coming up. Would you like to tell people how you got into this idea of decentralization?
Yeah, that's a great starting point. For me, it was pretty much when I lost my health as well. So 6 years ago, I had one too many concussions. And you know, I played soccer in college. So I was resulting of a lot of those, but I basically had a concussion, did everything wrong in the acute recovery phase. So that first like 1-2 months, and then 3-4 months after the injury, I was still having daily headaches, you know, extreme symptoms, fatigue, sensitivity, noise, light, sound, classic, you know, TBI symptoms. And I went to a neurologist. Finally, I was really excited to go to an expert and be told how I could get better. And I remember the neurologist, you know, officially diagnosed me with having post-concussive syndrome, which I was really elated about in the moment because then I had an answer to my issues. But then in the next moment, he said, or I asked him, what could I do to get better then? You know, what should I do to accelerate my recovery and get back on track? Because I went from being a college athlete and an engineering student to, you know, needing to sleep 12 to 14 hours a day, can't exercise, you know, just extremely irritable. And he said, just take it easy, you know, just try and get back into your daily routine and, you know, you'll slowly get better. And it was just devastating for me. And, you know, I was in a bad state mentally after that happened. But then that summer when I was still dealing with my symptoms, I started reconnecting with nature. I had an internship in Oregon, and I started feeling better the more I kind of got outside and alleviated some of my symptoms, to the point where I was like, this is not it. This is not my new normal. I'm 22 years old. You know, I'm a really high functioning person before this injury. So I'm also a little stubborn. Let's see what's out there for the information that can potentially, you know, allow me to have a better life. And I did that. I started consuming everything, you know, books on self-healing, brain injuries, YouTube videos, podcasts. I realized there's this whole health optimization space out there for free. And a lot of people have their own self-healing journey. And that's why I love talking to people like yourself. We've all come a long ways and had to figure it out ourselves. And that's, you know, a decentralized journey in and of itself. But that was before I even knew any of that. So that's kind of where I got turned on to just being, you know, in the driver's seat, being more individually sovereign from a health perspective in your life. And then that was before all this COVID stuff happened, which only exacerbated the importance of really being the person who makes decisions about your body and your health. And then simultaneously, I was, you know, getting really passionate about Bitcoin, because I saw the importance of being in control of your finances and being in control of your money. And then 2020 happened. COVID, lockdowns, the macroeconomic environment was crazy. It started printing all this money, and it clicked for me. You know, why was I passionate about both of these things? It was for the same reason. It's because I had my health taken away from me. I was extremely limited, and I couldn't do the things that I wanted to do. And I never wanted to feel like that again. So I never wanted to be in a position where I was stuck or trapped, and I wanted to have control over my life. So since then, I've kind of been just a proponent of that. And I really enjoy the Bitcoiners, and I really enjoy the health space. But I felt like we were all, or the people in those spaces were all thinking the same way, but they weren't talking to each other. So in 2021, I wrote a book called Bitcoin and Beef, which talked about why decentralization matters and why our centralized systems have robbed the individual's quality of life in the modern world we live in, and how we can fix that with some more decentralized solutions such as Bitcoin, such as regenerative agriculture, such as buying food locally, such as education. And you know, that got me kind of on the map with some people. I put myself out there on social media, connected with so many like-minded individuals. And then, yeah, in the past couple of years, I've leaned into my electrical engineering background and taken a deep dive on the electromagnetic aspects of our biology. So EMFs are a big part of that. Sunlight is a big part of that. It's this kind of, for me, this continuous journey of learning. You know, it started a lot with like the food system and farming, and now it's diving deep into electromagnetism and why this matters. So for one thing, I think decentralization and individual sovereignty is that continuous learning path that we're all on, because you realize we really don't know that much, especially about our health and our biology, because of the fiat monetary system kind of closing a lot of doors and silencing a lot of voices in the past, you know, 50 years. And we need to open those doors back up. And that's why conversations, podcasts like this are so important. And it's really exciting to talk to people who value that sort of perspective.
Yes. So decentralization is a really broad topic. And you touched there on food, health, finance, education, EMF. And it is startling to realize that some of the things that we've learned in school or in society don't hold up under the light of day when you're actually going through and you're experiencing them and you have the ability to get information from legitimate sources. Would you agree?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, you can think what you want of the internet, but that's one thing that's been really nice is like, you know, we have this abundance of information available to us. So if you dig deep enough, you can actually find like some really cool stuff that nobody's talking about and, you know, can't be silenced on all fronts. They can try and curate the narrative, but you know, compared to 50 years ago, we have a lot more freedom in that regard. So we can go and find, and we can go and find things that are, you know, very old in the literature to support what we think may be true.
So with all this in mind, there's an ancient principle in medicine that all the body needs to be healthy is to give it what it needs and don't give it what's going to harm it. you know, kind of a very primitive way to look at things. But when I listen to your podcast and look at your writing, you're talking about some really fundamental things like eating single ingredient foods and getting sunshine and putting your feet on the ground. Is that right?
Yeah, it's funny, and you can dive deep into this stuff, but if you just zoom out and think of like what logically makes sense, and as an engineer, I think of everything like a system. We're kind of this supercomputer. We're a sack of water mostly, and have a supercomputer powering that. And what are the inputs and the outputs to the system? And you know, the outputs are obvious, right? Like energy, vitality, emotional stability, just fulfillment. And how do we align those outputs is we align the inputs. So our bodies are tuned to be, you know, functioning properly when they're connected to their local environment and nature. Everything that's modern is a blip in the, you know, evolution of life and humanity. We're talking millions of years, and then if you're for humanity, even like hundreds of thousands of years of biology being very tightly tuned to the earth, to nature, and that is sunlight, grounding, and you know, that's eating real food, like you said.
So in looking at the legitimate inputs, single ingredient foods, pure water, pure air, you know, healthy, clean air to breathe, we think that's pretty much covers most of it, except there's this other piece. And that other piece is a dimension we can't see and most of us can't feel. And it is the electromagnetic realm. And I just want to start this part of our conversation by mentioning this whole business of us versus them, and the control that gives in society is based on taking a group of people who have everything in common. You know, from my perspective, all created in the image and likeness of God. And then you see if you can separate out certain people and say, well, those people are different. They're not us. And the marginalization happens in so many different ways in society. And it seems like that's something that, you know, wisdom would dictate we don't want to be a part of. So there are people who can feel the presence of EMF, but not the natural type. So there is a native environment in the world that has a very complex electromagnetic environment, complete with a huge electric field that we live in, a huge magnetic field that we live within, and then a variable magnetic field we call the Schumann resonance or set of resonances that is native to the earth. And then we have energy coming from the sun, including the visible part of the spectrum. We can see all the colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. But there's something above, ultraviolet, and there's something below. There's infrared. So, and then we see that in our biology, we have bacteria and whatnot talking to one another, whispering back and forth using electromagnetic energy. So those are the majority of what is legitimate coming from the electromagnetic spectrum. The illegitimate is everything man-made. You know, all the disease of civilization came with just nothing more than the electric grid as it spread across the world. So that's an awesome thing. And then every step after that, radar, satellites, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, cell phones, and all of that is, you could think of it as introducing noise. You know, as an engineer, you maybe think about a signal-to-noise ratio. So the us versus them that I was talking about is people like myself who have had a health journey, and we've been able to feel the electromagnetic environment. It's not nature that bothers us. It's all the man-made stuff. So with that as a little bit of an introduction, can you talk about your interest in EMF and kind of how you think about EMF and how much it should be embraced or avoided. And I'll just turn it over to you to talk about EMF a bit.
Yeah. Where to go with this? I could talk for, you know, 5 hours. It's so interesting. And again, for me, being an electrical engineer, I was aware of EMFs like 4 or 5 years ago when I was hearing about it on the Biohacker podcast. I've been turning my phone on airplane mode for a long time and learned about grounding and all these things. But really then a couple of years ago, after I wrapped up my second edition of my book, I decided to take a deeper dive because I realized that, you know, this is a big gap, right? There's not a lot of people who understand electromagnetism, even to like a level 2 degree. And then there's not a lot of people who understand its effect on our biology. This is a multidisciplinary realm and they're very complex topics. So that's why it's awesome to kind of bring light to this, because I think the alternative health space, it's been minimal, unfortunately, but it's accelerating. You know, there's more people posting about it. There's more people becoming aware of the effects of, like you said, non-native electromagnetic fields. And the way I see it again is, you know, you laid out beautifully the electromagnetic spectrum that is natural to our environment. You know, being in the low frequency range with the Earth's magnetic electric field, and then we have sunlight. So we have just a couple slivers of the very vast electromagnetic spectrum that is playing a big part in our life. And then now all of a sudden we have all of these alien frequencies that are completely man-made generated. And it's clear based on the literature that it's having effect on our biology. And again, it's a very inconvenient truth for many people, even people in the health space, because we all use technology, we're all on the internet. To me, it's just fundamentally the most pervasive environmental toxin that exists is non-native electromagnetic radiation or EMFs. And you could tie like blue light into that category as well, because our technology and our lighting is, you know, one and the same, and light, it's all light at the end of the day. It's all photons. So sometimes you can tie that together. But the way I think about it is that people just need to become aware that this is a real issue, that the devices we're using for hours and hours each day is having an impact on our health. It's having an impact on our mental health. It's having an impact on, you know, the most energy intensive areas of our bodies, our heart, our brain, our reproductive organ. It's affecting fertility, which is now, you know, a crisis worldwide. It's affecting our stress, both at a, you know, mitochondrial level and then at a cognitive level. And if we don't address this at all in the coming years, it's only going to continue to get worse. And most importantly, now we have, you know, this true epidemic that children are being handed high EMF technology and devices when they're 2 to 3 years old. You know, mothers that are pregnant are being exposed to high amounts of these EMFs. And it's resulting in what? Mental health issues younger and younger, suicide rates skyrocketing, chronic disease proliferating at earlier and earlier ages. And this trend will only continue unless education becomes somewhat more widespread and we actually have better technology and better standards around the use of technology. But as you and I know, there can be a big difference made by just understanding the basics, like that distance is your best friend. And if you don't hold your phone next to your head and use it on speaker and wired headphones, like that's a massive difference. Or turning things off at nighttime. So people have this interesting perspective on what EMFs are. Right away, it goes into the woo-woo category, which is quite comical because electromagnetism is the foundation for life. And then you have the whole other crew that, you know, are on the boat that non-ionizing radiation has no biological effects, even though, you know, there's 2,500 plus studies saying otherwise, from decades of research, probably even more than that. And yeah, to me, it's something that if you care about your health, you obviously need to be taking into consideration. So it's cool that you have your podcast where you mostly talk about EMFs. I talk a ton about it on social media, but it's just one area that we need to think about. And we're talking about the inputs and outputs, right? So if you're giving your body the wrong electromagnetic inputs, the outputs are going to be in disarray. And that's just a matter of fact. And how it's interacting with our biology at the level of the water, at the level of the mitochondria, it's really, to me, the biggest toxin, because that is what our body is designed to absorb and emit. So if we, you know, provide it the wrong inputs in that regard, we're going to have a whole lot of chaos, which is a whole lot of inflammation, which leads to a whole lot of chronic disease. So maybe that's a high level starting point, but it's really been my mission to, you know, get more of the general health space aware of EMFs, and it's working. More people are talking about light, more people are talking about EMFs. That's not just solely because of me either. It's accelerating and it's great. And I think we needed to get like the hardcore EMF community, like yourself and the guests you've had on, speaking on more of these shows, because it's the knowledge you guys have is very important and valuable, and people are starting to be open to this idea now.
Well, what a great overview. And towards the end there, you were talking about the fact that all of it, no matter whether you're talking about low frequency or whether you're talking about radio frequency, radiation, millimeter wave, all of it results in oxidative stress, right? Which opens the door for any chronic disease. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is, like, I got into this EMF space very deep in the past couple of years, and I realized there's actually a lot of debate that people like have on how it's affecting our biology, you know, what's the main mechanism of action. And it doesn't really matter. Like, you could, you know, whether it's voltagated calcium channels or something else affecting our water, like you said, oxidative stress is occurring, right? So we know that's going to happen, whether that's because it's the radio frequency or the low frequency, you know, pulsing. Again, these are nuances that we need to just understand don't really matter when we're trying to convince more and more people that the matter of fact is it's affecting our biology in a negative way. And yeah, loss of that redox, homeostasis, oxidative stress, causing mitochondrial dysfunction, is going to lead long-term to nearly, if not all, chronic diseases.
Great, great. So, and the cure seems so simple. I work with people who have been profoundly damaged, including myself when I started off. And all it seems to take to get better is to, as I alluded to earlier, take in what you need, what's healthful, what's helpful for the body, and to withhold what's harmful to it. And then as I talk to different authors who've written books and people who have experienced this and my clients in their homes, people seem to get better from an amazing array of different things. So I wonder if we could kind of turn now and begin talking about how the sun can never be replaced, because that is the obvious, legitimate source of electromagnetic radiation. It's that big ball burning up in the sky in there. And much of that energy that it liberates is not visible and has profound effects on our biology. I was just so impressed with the paper that you wrote regarding this very recently on Substack. And I wonder if you could maybe take us through, just at a high level, what you shared in that article.
Yeah, well, it's a good transition, because people always say that the electromagnetic radiation coming from the sun is magnitudes higher than any RF or ELF, so it could never be an issue. And it's like, yeah, that's true. The energy of higher frequency waves in the visible light spectrum, UV spectrum, they're far higher energy. They're far higher frequency. So that doesn't matter, because this is what our biology is tuned to utilize. This is what we are built to use. This is what's exciting the electrons in our body. You know, our biology is running off electrons, protons, and photons. And the photons coming from the sun have enough energy to excite those electrons to a higher state, have a photoelectric effect. And this is, you know, causing a lot of downstream actions, causing biological semiconduction. And it's also an absorption and then an emission, which is often under-discussed. But we are a giant light show. We're absorbing light and then we're emitting light. You can see infrared cameras of people. We're generating light. Biophotonics is a cool rabbit hole to go down, and some new research is coming out in that area that, you know, very low level, low intensity light is, like you said, our microbes, and then also our own cells, our mitochondria, which, you know, our bacteria in origin as well, are using to communicate. So this spectrum of sunlight from UV B to infrared is what actually is reaching the surface. So that is surface of the earth, that is, right? So there are radio frequencies, there are x-rays, a lot more is coming from the sun, but what's actually making it to the surface of the earth is, you know, visible light, UVA, UVB, and then the infrared spectrum. It's mostly near infrared and then far infrared. I think most of the mid infrared range is getting actually blocked by the ionosphere. So this is what mammalian biology is, I mean, all life really is used to receiving as an input signal. I mean, this is the main provider of life. This is the main energy stimulus in our environment. And, you know, people think that all of our energy is coming from food, and this is not the case. It's a different form of energy. But there's researchers like Dr. Alexander Wunsch who say we're really only getting 1/3 of our total energy from food, and the rest is from sunlight. That's going to change depending on where you live and what time of year it is. But it's true. However, it's a different form of energy. Like I said, it's purely photons, and we need food. We need grounding and connection to the earth and things like this to provide electrons and protons and the building blocks of life. So I'm not saying you can just go outside and, you know, get all your energy from the sun forever. You can get quite a bit and probably go longer than you think without food. But the most important part is what I said in that article is that we can't replace sunlight. Why? Because it's so vast. It's a broadband emitter. And that spectrum between ultraviolet B and infrared, far infrared, it's so vast. And the infrared spectrum within itself is massively wide in terms of the wavelengths it's covering. So when we just have a light like an LED, that's a very narrow band of wavelengths that we're being exposed to. And this is the problem with modern indoor lighting, is that we're not getting the full spectrum that we would get with sunlight. So sunlight is inherently vast. It's inherently continuous as well. It's not pulsed, which is a major issue with screens and LEDs, the flicker, the pulsing in the, you know, 1,000 to 50,000 times per second, which is another non-native EMF in and of itself. And then it's not balanced. The spectrum of sunlight has everything from UV, which is very high energy, violet, blue light. Blue light gets a bad rep because it's very damaging to our circadian rhythm when used in the wrong context. But blue light is how our body tells time, our body clock, our circadian rhythm. Debatably the most important aspect of health, in my opinion, because think about society. What if everybody was running around with a watch on the wrist to tell time and it all had a different time on it? It would be pure chaos. It would not be conducive to getting anything done. You'd be showing up to meetings late. You'd be, you know, this podcast, maybe we started 20 minutes late because we both had different time on our wrist. That's what's happening in our body when we have a dysfunctional circadian rhythm. And that master clock is in our brain. It's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that's what's being set by blue light predominantly. So blue light's extremely important. It's what wakes you up in the morning. Secretion of cortisol, suppressing melatonin production. But if you have that blue light in the wrong context, such as 10 p.m., you're staring at your phone in your bed, you know, that's going to be a net negative for health. But in nature, in sunlight, that doesn't exist. The sun is up. You'll never get blue light without red and infrared. And why is that important? Well, red and infrared are quote unquote more healing frequencies of light. And what that basically means is they're lower energy. They're less stimulating to our biology, but they have a profound effect in a positive manner. The near infrared light stimulates melatonin production in the mitochondria, so it can deal with oxidative stress better. Melatonin is probably the most potent antioxidant that we endogenously produce. It's expanding our exclusion zone water. So recently podcasted with Dr. Gerald Pollack, who is the leading world expert in water research, and it's near infrared light expands our water battery, our ability to hold charge, potential charge within our body more than any other light frequency. So near infrared, red light, and that's why red light therapy has become very popular as a biohacking modality, because it stimulates, it upregulates energy production. Whether you think that's ATP or from the water side of things, you can debate that. So it balances out, right? You're never getting blue. You're never getting UV light without red. And that's where people will be like, oh, well, UV is really bad for our health. It causes skin cancer. You can go look at most of those studies and they're UV light in isolation. They're never doing the full spectrum of sun. And the light environment of those laboratories are typically very skewed. So why is that important? It's because you never really are getting UV light in nature without have been exposed to red, near infrared, blue, UVA, and then finally UVB throughout the day, right? It's this progression of time. You don't get UV light at sunrise. That's for good reason, because it's priming your body for the light that it's going to be exposed to for the rest of the day. So it's photo conditioning your cells, and then it's able to handle that oxidative stress load from the UV exposure and not get burned, still produce melanin, still produce vitamin D, which are extremely important to our health from many angles. And that's why sunlight is so important, because it's full spectrum and it's this progression throughout the day, and then you hit high noon, and then that is a digression in terms of the energy of wavelengths you're exposed to. And that's how our biology operates. It's ready for that constant change, that dynamic. That's how our body, again, is telling time, because that blue light, that sun angle, that brightness, it's all imperative to how our biology is functioning. And that's why artificial indoor lighting is extremely toxic. It's extremely non-native from an electromagnetic radiation perspective. And I think something that everyone can do to improve their health is just to think about their light environment a little bit more.
Brilliant. Yeah. So many great things that you mentioned there. So that big ball in the sky is actually helping us to coordinate the various biological processes that we have going on in our body. It needs to know what part of the day it is. It needs to know what season as well. We didn't talk about that, but it definitely needs to know what time of the day it is. And it does that by the temperature of the light or the different colors that are present in the spectrum. You know, before we had these automatic cameras with their automatic white balance and whatnot, you could take some transparency film and photograph something in early morning sunshine, in midday, in the evening, in shadows, and you'll really see the difference in the light temperature. And one of the unique things about our biology is, unless we're trained in that with our eyes, we don't really see all the time the subtle differences in the light temperature or in the colors that are available in a particular scenario or at a particular time of day, but your biology does. And that's what's critical. And I like what you mentioned about the LED lights. You know, if I wanted to harm a society, which I don't, and I never would, I would do it through RF radiation and screwing with the lighting. And this, what I mentioned about our biology needing these light signals, as you were talking about, and us not being able to necessarily perceive a little bit bluish light versus white light. When we start to put all the blue light signals in our house, that's not a good thing. When we're staring at the blue light screen, that's not a good thing. So I really appreciate your bringing up the comments about blue light. And yeah, it's a part of the EMF thing because it's a part of the electromagnetic spectrum as well. I love what you mentioned about skin cancer and, you know, that scam that somehow this big ball in the sky is harmful to us. You know, I first got in touch with that in a great book called Health and Light by John Ott. And he described, did you read that?
I've read pieces of it and then I've watched the documentary a few times.
Yeah, so
he's incredible.
Yeah. He described how his arthritis was cured by taking his glasses off and getting intentional exposure of sunlight, including the ultraviolet. This is not medical advice. I'm just telling you what I read in a book. And you mentioned your interview with Gerald Pollack. What a great interview that was. One of the things that really made an impact on me from that interview was he was talking about how this exclusion zone water, which is the water that exists in our cells, how it contracts when you shine man-made light on it, radio frequency radiation. And I don't know if that it was contracted by 30% or something. And then when you exposed it to the infrared light, it expanded, I think it was four times something, 400% mm-hmm. or something like that. But yeah, so many great, great points there. So yeah, EMF is a huge thing. And the cure, part of the cure is natural lighting and exposing yourself to that and getting full spectrum and realizing that LED lights are harmful to our biology. And you talked about earthing as well. So tell me a little bit about earthing and why that's important.
Yeah. Grounding or earthing or getting bare feet on the earth is tremendously important for a few reasons. It's plugging into the source. So we're getting an input signal there, but just being connected to the earth directly. Studies show that earthing improves cortisol rhythms, which means that it's directly affecting our circadian rhythm. You know, it's another way for our body to understand where you are, what time it is, what time of day, season. You mentioned that as well. I think the circadian and then I think infraradian rhythms are seasonality or anything longer than 24 hours. But also what's really important and most talked about with earthing is this pool of free electrons that is available to us on the surface of the earth. And why is that so important? Well, electrons are what our biology runs off of. And pretty much everyone in the modern world is deficient in electrons. I would imagine from the nutrient deficient diet, from the disconnection to being on the earth, you'd imagine, you know, for all of humanity, just look at nature. All animals are always connected to the earth. So our skin is able to absorb some electron flow. And I think I pulled up a study with some electrical engineers, and I've tried to measure this myself. It's a very low amount of current. It's in the microamp or nanoamp range of the current that we're absorbing from the earth, but it is there. And that might sound very low to people, but that's still like hundreds of billions or a trillion electrons per second. So it's a lot, and it can make a difference because what can those electrons be used for? They can be used for building the exclusion zone, building our water battery, having more energy, and then also combating oxidative stress, right? Quenching these free radicals that need electrons before they cause a bunch of damage in our cells. And it's free, you know, it's natural, it's accessible to anybody. It can be hard in certain times of year. It's cold out, you know, modern societal norms, but if you just think of it, we, before the advent of rubber shoes, we just had leather shoes or we had bare feet. And that's also providing some conductivity. And I've done a lot of experiments personally on seeing what works from, you know, being grounded. And I like to use the AC body voltage test as a way to test what's actually grounding you. So then you're also just, you know, we should be connected. And you could debate whether it's having a primary of positive effect on EMFs, if it's a bad thing to ground in a high EMF environment. And that's a nuanced topic in and of itself. And I would always recommend addressing the EMF environment before grounding. Connecting to the earth directly with your feet or a rod is way, way, way better than plugging into your outlet. I don't do that personally, plugging into my outlet. And yeah, it's just another input signal. It's another source of electrons that we have, and no one does it anymore. It's like insane how in a matter of a couple hundred years, we just removed a massive source of electrons to our biology. And we wonder again why, you know, these modern chronic diseases are proliferating at such a high level. So big fan of grounding, earthing. I think it's really important. And it ties really well into the electromagnetic, you know, discussion about our biology.
Yeah, exactly. And what you said about, you know, when we make big changes quickly and we don't do a controlled experiment to determine whether it's a good idea, that's when we have the greatest capacity to get in trouble. So I think I remember from the earthing book that a study was done in the late 50s that indicated that 95% of Americans wore leather-soled shoes. So that means from that point in history all the way back to the creation, people had their feet on the ground directly, or, you know, they had a skin, you know, leather between their foot and the ground, which once it's mineralized with perspiration and whatnot, it gives you conductivity to the ground. So people had that all the way up until, you know, 95% of them, even in the 1950s in the U.S. The same study was repeated in the late 90s, and it indicated that 95% of the people wore shoes that had insulated soles, like plastic soles, rubber, you know, of some type. So totally insulating from the surface of the earth. So you've got all nature, you know, all mammals have their feet in touch with the ground. All plants are rooted into the ground. And we just said, meh, you know, so took a left turn there. And so, yeah, I think earthing is so important. I like that you're, I know from listening to your content, that you're a fan of feet on the ground, not going out and buying expensive earthing products. I think that's great. And you mentioned that there is current flow. One thing I forgot to say earlier about the natural electromagnetic environment of the earth is that it's all direct current. And Becker's work showed that it's all direct current. One of my careers was in emergency medicine. We'd put patches on, you know, somebody's chest, and we could look at the electrical activity in their heart. That's direct current. Your heart is being polarized and depolarized. It's not alternating current. There is no alternating current in our bodies and in nature. So you've got this direct current source of electrons between the sole of your foot and the rest of your biology. It appears to do a lot of wonderful things, not the least of which is reducing the inflammation, as you mentioned. And when people are grounding through the electrical system in a building, for example, well, you're potentially, because that is bonded to the common conductor, you're potentially opening up current flow of a different type. And one thought about current flow is that could be viewed as ionizing within the body. So I don't know. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I just don't think it's, I think you need to be aware that this is a possibility that it could have a negative effect, right? So it's hard to say. I mean, I've interviewed, what's his name? Gaetan Chevalier, and he did all this work with Clint Ober, the grounding earthing guy. And he was like, you know, as long as your outlets are wired properly and they're actually grounded, it's fine to do that. But in my personal opinion, you're running a risk that we don't really have a complete answer to. And this is why we need decentralized science to verify these things. But it's quite challenging to measure as well. So I personally would not, I don't personally ground into an outlet, especially if you don't trust the wiring, which probably most people would say that they don't trust their houses wired or their apartments wired like perfectly. And then, yeah, you have the common neutral that could potentially have some stray or dirty electricity. And I've measured, I mean, the ground actually in your outlet is typically a bit higher, lower than the ground on the earth. You know, there's, you know, a couple hundred millivolt difference. And as someone who's looking at that from like a power distribution perspective, that's peanuts in terms of voltage. But for our biology, it's massive. And one thing Becker talked about, right, is that the intensity of the amperage in our biology is minuscule. It's tiny to have impact. And it's in that microamp, nanoamp range. So you're kind of just playing with the, you know, playing with fire. So some people might be so electron deficient that it gives them a benefit in the short term, but I would be very skeptical and wary to be grounding in an outlet regularly. And yeah, I think putting a rod into the earth is probably a better option.
Yeah, I mentioned that, you know, my personal background, and then I work with a lot of people who have been damaged in going into their homes and doing an EMF assessment, helping them do remediation. I've never met somebody who's been brought to the point where they can feel the harm more or less real time from man-made radiation. I don't see any of them doing anything other than, you know, putting their feet on the ground. In fact, funny story, just this last week, I was talking to a new client, and the client's friend, and he was saying that this new client of mine was so bad, they had to bury him. And I thought, what? Yeah, they went out and, yeah, I mean, the ground is, you know, we're pretty northern latitude here, so it's kind of cold outside. They dug a big hole. They put their friend in it, obviously left his head out and gently put the earth around him. And they were talking about what an amazing fact that had effect that had on his health quickly. But
somebody wrote about that as well. I don't remember who it was, but it was maybe an EMF book, but they basically said that they got buried in the sand at the beach and that they didn't want to leave because they felt so much better. So it's a similar thing. And it's like, wow, you know, it makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you had a very interesting conversation with Stephanie Seneff recently, where you talked about the many different problems with glyphosate. And you also published an article recently on deuterium. So I wonder if we could kind of pivot a little bit on and go to talk about deuterium. And for those people who have not heard of deuterium, it's just a type of hydrogen that has more than one too many, I guess I would say. And it is present in nature, and it's present in water. Some types of water have less deuterium. Some types have too much. But in the body, what's clear is too much deuterium is not a good thing. And I have listened to so-called experts in the alternative medicine space talk forever about another topic, which is seed oils. And seed oils are terrible, you know, for, and if you knew how and why these things came on the scene and were proposed as something we want to use as preparing our food or eating in any kind of quantity, yeah, you'd be aghast. So I've known for a long time seed oils are to be avoided, and there are some legitimate sources of fat like ghee, like butter, like tallow, And then there's all the corn oil, soybean oil, canola oil, all those type of things. What I never realized until last week when I read your most recent Substack article was maybe the real problem with seed oils, or what accounts for a huge part of the problem with seed oils, is the deuterium. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mentioned a lot of great things. Well, I think glyphosate, to be honest, if I have to put it like the most detrimental environmental toxins, it's got to be glyphosate right below, non-native EMFs, including blue light. It's everywhere. It's in our food. It's extremely detrimental to our biology in many, many ways because it has the ability to substitute for glycine, which is a very important amino acid. So it can cause havoc in nearly every system in our body, specifically our gut microbiome, and that leads to issues with, aromatic amino acids and neurotransmitters and the whole slew. So definitely check out Stephanie Seneff's book, Toxic Legacy, on that. But something that she uncovered was that glyphosate also has a direct relationship with deuterium, because our gut is where we can produce this deuterium depleted gas, which gets used for basically the building blocks of what we need to make in our body. And yeah, deuterium is basically just heavy hydrogen. So it's an isotope of hydrogen, has a neutron as well as a proton in the nucleus. And because of that, it's twice the mass. So it's the only isotope of any element that has such a substantial difference in its mass. And even though there's only roughly 150 parts per million of deuterium for every hydrogen or protium or proton, because of that vast difference in its mass, it has a vast impact on biological functions. And we need some of it for certain things, but in excess, yeah, it can become a huge problem. And specifically in the mitochondria, because I don't know how familiar audience is with the depths of the mitochondria, but we basically have these proteins that are pumping protons, and then we have this nano motor, which is called the ATP synthase, which is creating ATP. So we have this mini, chain of pumps, and then a motor at the end, and it's really cool. It's all powered via, an electromagnetic gradient of proton voltage or differential in charge, right? So imagine you have some sort of motor, and all of a sudden what you're running through that motor is twice as heavy. It's going to cause it to stall. It's going to cause it to kind of not work properly. And then that's basically what happens in our mitochondria. So deuterium, when it gets into the electron transport chain, can really cause a lot of issues with these protein pumps and the motor, the nanomotors. And that's what's, causing a whole host of issues. And we have this ability naturally to strip out deuterium and make sure it doesn't get into the electron transport chain with steps like the Krebs cycle, steps like glycolysis. However, when we have a vast excess of deuterium, and then you can deplete deuterium via sweating, via sunlight exposure as well. And the problem is with our modern diet is we now have highly processed foods. So carbohydrates are naturally higher in deuterium because plants store deuterium in their glucose. So anything very sweet will be higher in deuterium. But again, our body has this mechanism to deplete the deuterium, to strip it out so that it doesn't get into areas where it can cause a whole host of issues. And again, sunlight plays a role in that because sunlight moves mass. Like, more energy from the sun can move mass, can also deplete heavy metals as well. So you can almost think of deuterium like sort of like a heavy metal. You need to detox from it constantly, and sunlight helps with that. So people can get away with eating more carbohydrates in a higher UV, higher sunlight environment. So the summer versus the winter where we live, Keith. Or kind of if you live where I'm at currently, which I'm in El Salvador for the brief moment here, people can get away with eating, carbohydrates. And guess what grows around here all year? Fruit. We don't have fruit in the winter in Wyoming, I can tell you that much. So what does this have to do with seed oils? Well, fats are naturally deuterium depleted. We're talking, you know, pasture raised, 100% grass-fed animal fat is on the level of like 110 parts per million, let's say. And carbohydrates are going to be much higher, like 150, 160 parts per million. Now, that might not sound like a huge difference, but that 40 parts per million, that, you know, 30% difference can be a vast change in biological function. Because again, there's a threshold with what your body can deal with. Now, the thing about fats is they actually are supposed to be deuterium depleted. So our body doesn't have as many filtering steps or steps to strip them out before they cause a whole host of damage. Carbohydrates, it's like they know, our body knows it's going to be higher in deuterium. So they have all these steps in glycolysis to basically strip that out. So enter seed oils. Seed oils are probably the most processed food on the planet. You can look up, there's some cool charts that show the tortured journey of a seed to become a seed oil. And, you know, there's everything from chemical extraction with solvents such as hexane, there's deodorization, there's bleaching, coloring. They're basically putting lipstick on a pig 10 times over because it's such a foul substance after they use it and or after it goes through this process that they have to recolor it, make it look like this buttery yellow color. They put deodorizer on it so you don't smell the rancidness because it's a polyunsaturated fat that's been pretty much fully oxidized. And then some of them go through partial hydrogenation. So within these steps, especially if it goes through some sort of partial hydrogenation, which is like hydrogen, a ton of deuterium is being added to the seed oil because anything that's made in a lab is going to be made in the shortcut fashion. So it's not going to be naturally deuterium depleted. So for example, the hydrogen gas that would be used to hydrogenate it, our body makes that internally in our gut. And that's where the glyphosate story has an impact. That could be anywhere as low as 30 to 50 parts per million of deuterium. So really, really low. And if they're making that in a lab, they would have to culture microbes from like our gut to produce that gas naturally. They're not going to do that. It's way too time consuming. It's way too challenging. So they use just some other way. And that ends up being far more, you know, far higher in deuterium. And then that gets added to the seed oil. So I talked with Dr. Laszlo Boros, who's an expert on this. And he said that seed oils were the highest deuterium food that they have ever measured, you know, 170 to 200 parts per million. And again, why is that such a problem? Because it's a fat. Fats are supposed to be lower, so our body has no mechanism to deal with that. So when we're regularly consuming seed oils, that is causing a massive deuterium influx into our mitochondria that is causing a whole host of damage and, you know, energy production, the ability to deal with oxidative stress. It's all going to be hampered, and we're just going to have a whole host of cellular inflammation. So I wrote that article because it was something I was personally curious about for a long time and, you know, had to talk to the experts on multiple occasions to get an answer because there's not a whole lot of data out there. Again, why we need decentralized science to test these things. And that was the conclusion. So, yes, the oxidation, the rancidity of polyunsaturated fats are very bad. Polyunsaturated fats in general are more susceptible to that. But to me, one of the major reasons that nobody is talking about as to why seed oils are so toxic is deuterium levels of extremely unnatural thresholds that our body has absolutely no way of dealing with because it's in the form of a fatty acid instead of a carbohydrate. So a shitty fat is worse than a shitty carb, in my opinion. So seed oils, probably worse than eating candy. And especially from the carbohydrate perspective, if you're in a high sunlight environment, you can get away with that a little bit more.
Yeah, and all these attacks or all these situations seem to come together in the following way. As you've mentioned here, illegitimate fats, I'll just call them that, things that should not be in our diet. They look like axle grease in their natural state, and it's not until they're chemically altered beyond recognition that they're presented in these bottles in the supermarket and we're encouraged to consume this. It's a recipe for disaster with regard to health because of everything you've just said. The deuterium level in a fat, together with our biology. Now, we would have some hope of being able to counteract that with the things that live in our gut, except Roundup, except glyphosate. Yeah. Glyphosate had three different patents. And anyway, it wipes out our microbiome. It has a capacity to wipe out
the microbiome. Yeah, it was an antibiotic, right? Like one of those patented use cases.
Yeah, it was antibiotic, absolutely. The first one was as a chemical stripper. I think it was Allied Chemical or something. And so it demineralizes. But what I'm focusing on is you know, having excess deuterium in a fat in the body doesn't mesh with our biology. We would have a chance to recover from this, except that nobody can avoid glyphosate, and it's wiping out our microbiome, where we could produce gas that would counteract the high levels of deuterium. And then the triple whammy is EMF, because what occurs in the mitochondria has to do with charge. What do electromagnetic fields of all frequencies do? They influence charge. Otherwise, they wouldn't work, right? You couldn't propagate through. Anyway.
No, that's a great summary, right? Because it's the toxic onslaught and we can't do it anymore. So people wonder why their grandparents could live to 100 years old drinking and smoking. Yeah, well, they got up. They watched the sunrise every day. They worked outside. They didn't have cell phone towers in every corner. They maybe had some electrical power, but they were using devices for 10 hours a day. They can get away with that stuff. We can't do that anymore because, like you said, we have this poisonous, high deuterium food, high glyphosate foods, destroying our mitochondria, our microbiome. The EMFs are then also doing that. They're also negatively impacting the microbiome. And then the lack of sunlight from indoor living is, you know, the cherry on top, or maybe even the main layer of it, who knows, because that's what's fueling the mitochondria. And then that is also what our gut needs to really be healthy and produce, you know, things like aromatics and neurotransmitters. So it's bad, but you know, the human body is resilient, but at a certain point you just hit it with too many stabs in the back, and it's going to keel over. So bringing awareness to these issues, which is what you're doing, is just so important.
So let's wrap up on a positive note, because we've talked about a lot of problems, and indeed these are very significant problems, and all I'm trying to do is encourage people to recognize these things and to take action. And there's a lot of great action that can be taken, and I think I see that in your work, Tristan. If you want to take this home, I think we could, between the two of us, give a great prescription for, you know, what is the antidote with all of this? So why don't you start?
For me, it's just being cognizant of the toxins in your environment and then living a life that's really hyper local, hyper connected to nature, because that is the source. So spending as much time outside as you possibly can, starters, living your life by the local environment and the light cycle. So getting up, watching sunrise, you know, spending time outside, whether it, you need to do work, like I have a deck, I sit outside, I eat outside, I exercise outside. Why? Because I know getting outside as much as possible is going to help me. And being in a blue lit gym, it's not it. You know, I like to work out. So in the winter it can be a little challenging, but that's why things, you know, like skiing or hiking or even just going for a light jog can be helpful. And yeah, that reconnection and really abiding by that as best you can. Everyone has a different scenario. And then blocking those toxins, you know, mitigating the EMFs, especially at nighttime, creating that sleep sanctuary, right? We didn't really talk about sleep too much, but sleep is where your body heals. I mentioned that I think circadian biology, circadian rhythms are the most important aspect of health because that dictates the quality of our sleep. Our sleep is where we are repairing and restoring the day's damage. So whatever you are exposed to during the day, you know, why could your grandpa smoke cigarettes and drink whiskey and be fine and live to 100? Because he slept pretty damn good. You know, he had good light environment, didn't have EMFs. You know, probably went to bed the same time every day for 80 years. And that allows for repairing, restoring, melatonin, all these things at the cellular level is being able to be combated. Now you add all these toxins and a terrible light environment, terrible EMF environment, you are not going to be able to get good quality sleep. So, you know, if that looks like turning your phone off, turning your Wi-Fi off, turning the lights off, getting blue light blockers, getting red light bulbs, getting candles. I do all of these things. It can be challenging at times. And yeah, prioritizing that reconnection to nature, eating real foods, eating hyper local. Big fan of, you know, nutrient dense animal foods, especially in the wintertime, and then eating local produce when it's available to me. But all these things, I think you can attack from a progression standpoint. You know, I've been working at this for 6 years now, and I'm always constantly improving, but perfection is not even possible in the real world, because we just have so many toxins that we're you know, dealing with. So I wouldn't become over neurotic about it, overwhelmed by it. Just strive for improvement. And then, you know, especially if you have family members, children, prioritizing education and their environment. And then, you know, something that we really need and something I'm working on now full time is creating healthier technology with a cool company called the Daylight Computer. So that's pretty much it for me. I think we have the ability to solve these issues. Most people probably won't take the initiatives, the actions, but for those who are willing and care, you can make a significant difference.
Well, I was making a mental list in my mind as you were talking, and you took them all. No, man, fantastic job of, summarizing a very broad discussion that we've had today. And I just want to echo, you know, the importance of getting to, if possible, zero EMF, working with a qualified local EMF consultant. If you want to know what a qualified local EMF consultant did, I've recorded two separate podcasts to help you find one in your local area. So even that should be decentralized. Absolutely agree with the local food. Local food is real food. This stuff that they're shipping around, that's not, you know, the benefit. I mean, it looks like food and it smells like food to some degree, but local is where it's at. It's where life is at. And if you have a job, I would just say where you're living under blue lights and staring at a screen all day, I just want to encourage you to think if that's what you want to be doing long term. And I also want to echo what Tristan said of, you know, journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. If this is your first introduction to all of this, don't go running away. Maybe start with something simple like watching the sunrise in the morning, turning off all the lights except maybe a candle or a red light bulb when it starts to get dark, and no screens until morning, and the rest of it can come later. So I want to finish with that. And Tristan, thank you. This has been a great conversation, and I appreciate your joining us today. How can people get in touch with you?
Thanks so much for having me, Keith. Yeah, it's been a pleasure. I have my podcast, Decentralized Radio. I post on my Substack, Tristan Decentralized Health. I'm on Twitter at Bitcoin_Beef. That is the book I wrote 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. If you want to check that out, it's on Amazon. And yeah, I'm working also for the Daylight Computer to bring healthier tech. So much more to come in that in the next couple months. So yeah, that's pretty much everything, Keith. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
The EMF Remedy Podcast is a project of EMF Remedy, LLC. We'd like to be your trusted guide for achieving a better EMF environment in your home. The contents on this podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are not intended to substitute for the advice provided by your doctor or other healthcare professional. It is not intended to be, nor does it constitute, healthcare or medical advice. Opinions of guests on this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the EMF Remedy Podcast.